Hello, Combi Nation. My name is Subi Sadeh. I've spent over a decade in medical device, pharma, and combination product development. Our industry feels complicated sometimes. Drugs, devices, clinical trials, submissions, sterilization, validation, design control, risk management, market access, reimbursement. The list goes on. My goal is mastery. So this podcast is to ask questions I have to people who may have the answers. Each week on the Combinate podcast, I talk to someone about their area to further understand and simplify. Whether you're a pharma person trying to understand the next wave of products, or a device person trying to navigate a pharma system you're unfamiliar with, or a newbie in both areas, I invite you to listen, and together we can simplify by combinating. Hi, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of the Combinate podcast. I'm your host, Subi Sadeh, and we are joined by Aaron Snyder today. Aaron is the VP of QA at Allitex. He's a faculty member through AMI, and he has a YouTube channel called Quality Systems Explained. Background in device, more recently, the last few years in pharma. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm excited about the podcast and let's just jump right in.
Yeah. So for background, Aaron and I have been chatting for about an hour. We started really early, kind of as the sun was coming up on a summer day kind of thing. And just we were talking about kind of the distinction between pharma and medical device regs. And maybe Aaron, if you can, just from your perspective, you spent something in the ballpark of 18 years on the medical device side and then moved into pharma. Can you maybe talk about where you were at when you started learning about the pharma regs and some of the glaring differences that you saw?
Yeah. So I started in medical device, and when early in my career, one of my mentors told me that if I wanted to learn the regulations and know 820, 1345, I needed to become an auditor. Specifically, I needed to become a corporate auditor. So I spent a number of years traveling around the world, auditing manufacturing facilities, design facilities, test labs, and learning the medical device quality system requirements. So 820, 1345. And I've seen good, bad, and I've seen mediocre, but all over the map. I've seen good systems. And when I was doing the auditing, about once or twice a year, we would go audit a pharma facility. And it could be Q7 APIs, or it may be a 211 facility. And it was very evident that we're both trying to do the same thing, right? We want a product that is safe and effective, and it does what the labeling says it's going to do, right? That's really important on both the device and the pharma side. But the way that we go about that, the things that we focus on are different because of the nature of the two products, medical devices being more mechanical in nature, pharmaceuticals being more chemical in nature. So there's a lot of focus on process validations on the device side, where you get into more test method validation, you get into cleaning validations a lot more heavily on the pharmaceutical side. Contamination control, they're treated differently in the two areas depending on the product. And what I quickly came to understand when just looking at the requirements themselves, the medical device regulation used to be called good manufacturing practices. But in the 1990s, it was updated to become the quality system regulation. So it went from being basically just focused on manufacturing to, okay, we need the design to be included. We need supplier management to be included. We need post-market to be included. So they added a lot more into it and made it a full quality system where you have systems that interact with each other. 211 on the pharma side hasn't gone through that evolution. It's still written to be quality control, facilities control, environmental control, and heavy, heavy testing of the product at the end of the process. When we get into the medical device side, you do the process validation so you can do less testing at the end of the process. So yeah, the pharma regs, I would say from the standpoint of 211, it's not built to be a quality system. It's laid out differently because it hasn't had that update that 820 had. Now, the pharma or industry as a whole has recognized that, and that's why we have those ICH documents where you get to bring in Q8, Q9, Q10, Q10 specifically to add in Kappa and some of the other processes that we need to build out a full quality system. But unfortunately, those are guidance documents and they're not part of the actual regulations themselves.
Do you find, because Amy is focused on medical devices primarily, right?
Yeah.
Is there any crossover into any of the pharma regs there? Like when you're teaching, do you ever teach about the distinctions between the two?
Yeah. So this started about 10 years ago, I would say, in the Amy courses. We started to get more and more IVD companies and people from IVDs and in vitro diagnostics. That's kind of, you're kind of bridging the two because there's the chemical part of how an IVD works, which you get into some of those laboratory controls and pharma controls that you might not have with a normal medical device. And then even more recently, combination products. So I know combination products started to come up on the radar in the late 2000s. I was in a manufacturing facility 2011, 12, 13. We had a heparin-coated catheter. So we had a biologic and we had the device. So we had a combo product. And in those Amy courses for the QSR, we get a lot of combo people now. We get people from the Pfizer, from Merck coming in and saying, okay, I need to understand medical device requirements. I've taught the medical device quality system requirements to CBER and CDER employees at FDA. And their thought process is different because of those products. And it's a challenge for them to understand how the device side went to the quality system approach versus what they had before, which was just the current good manufacturing practices.
So one thing that you said earlier, and I feel really dumb that I hadn't made the realization earlier, to be honest, but you know, you said that when the device regs went from good manufacturing practices to quality system, it went beyond manufacturing into design, into
yep.
purchasing, into so on and so forth.
Yep.
And I never thought about that kind of distinction being, oh, the GMPs are focused on manufacturing early and the QSRs are focused on manufacturing plus, 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 plus. I think
right.
the reason that I was struggling with that is because in pharma, it's called the GMPs, but they have, you know, things like QBD and right first time and things that are not exactly similar to, you know, design control, translating voice of customer user needs and safety into the product. But mm-hmm. they kind of like translate some of the mechanistic requirements, so to speak, into the product and follows that process. I guess, what are your thoughts on the ICH CGMP situation as compared to the QSR 13485 model?
Yeah, so if you read, now the QSR was written in the 1990s, so ISO 13485 was updated in 2016. So it does have more contemporary language and the FDA will be adopting 1345. The nice part about how 1345 is written is everywhere in the quality system where there could be additional regulatory requirements, they point to that. They basically say, you need to do this plus all other applicable regulatory requirements. So on the design side, it's product registration,
product realization.
I was going to say registration and listing, but that's for the facility. But you also have to do your submissions, right? Whether it's a 510K or a PMA. On the drug side, it'd be your NDAs or your ANDAs. But so when you get into your design control process, it's going to say, look, you've got to do those other regulatory requirements, labeling, product submissions, post-market. When you get to complaints, it'll say, yeah, you got to process complaints. And then if you're required to do a reportable or take a field action, other applicable regulatory requirements. When you get into to 211, it doesn't say anything about ICH, Q8, or Q9, or Q10. It's not there. Like, you have to be in the industry and know that, okay, for Kappa, we've got to go to ICH-Q10 because kappa is not listed in 211 at all. I think the European pharma regulations are a bit more clear on that, and they have the annexes that cover the various areas, so you get a little bit more with the annexes. But the way that 211 is written, if you just read 211, you wouldn't know what corrective actions and preventative actions are because it's not there.
When you were teaching the CDER, CBER folks, what was that like?
Yeah, we did 3 classes for just CBER. So it was only CBER employees. And it was, the first one was a real challenge for myself and the other faculty because we had to use examples that would kind of fit their approach to the products because they were asking questions that we hadn't received in any of the classes before because they're coming from this biologic standpoint. And then they didn't see it as an overarching quality system. They were focused on specific areas of control. And we would have to tailor our responses or our examples to those areas of control that they were familiar with and try to make that more of, okay, well, the overarching quality system, the design controls feeds into manufacturing, post-market data feeds back to design. You have purchasing, like I could purchase a service or a product in design, in manufacturing, in the post-market, anywhere in my quality system. Risk management, it goes over the whole thing. So helping them go from, okay, I'm worried about stability. Okay, well, stability is a single part of making sure that that product's okay, but you have more controls on top of that. And when you have an issue, that's feeding into another system.
So the 600 part of 21 CFR is focused on biologics, right?
And yeah.
How does that fit in against kind of 211 versus, you know, 1345? I haven't actually seen that. I know combination product obviously is drug or biologic and a device, and there's a clear part 4 streamlined approach that addresses both. But I'm wondering, is the approach for 600 any different than 211?
You'll have to get a 600 expert in here because I've gone through it once, like, and not the whole, because it references the whole 600 series. But if you check out the very, and I believe it's in 210, they talk about scope and applicability, and it points to 600 for biologics. For tissue products, it points to 1271 for devices. And basically what it'll say is, these are the good manufacturing processes for pharmaceutical. You also have biologics and tissue products. If those are also being used, if there are any conflicts between those regulations, the one specific to the product, or the one that's more specific, will override. So that one will take precedent. Yeah.
Where do you find most people struggle with the QSRs if they come from a device background, drug background?
I'm glad that you asked that. So when you look at the QSR, right, there's a heavy focus on process validation, and there's a heavy focus on process controls. But I think the area that individuals in the pharmaceutical space struggle with the most is design controls, because in the pharma space, you have your phase 1, 2, 3, 4 clinical trials, first in man, you do have GLPs, you have all of this stuff that kind of sets up how drug development works that's not into a 210, 211, right? And in the device side, on the quality system requirements, we have design controls, boom, right there in our quality system. And that's the front end of building our product. And as you stepwise walk through those design controls, you are going to hit things when you get to design transfer, like process validation, that has a much heavier focus in device than I've seen in the pharma sides.
Okay, interesting. So the GLPs and the clinical trial requirements, all of that is completely outside of 210, 211.
I haven't read 211.
I'm actually asking. I don't know.
Right. I haven't read 211 recently, but I mean, when you go through 211, you start out with the quality control unit. Then you go into facilities. Then you go into batch records, manufacturing. Then you get to QC and yield testing. And then at the end, you have records and drug salvage. So there's nothing there around the design of the pharmaceutical product. That's covered in other regulations.
You know, I interviewed a person who's focused on clinical trials, and he was pointing to some section, I believe, around IRBs. And I remember going in and looking like 21 CFR 803 or something. It was some number that I had never heard of before.
And so 803 is medical device reportable. So it wasn't 803, but wasn't
that's funny because there are some folks in quality who are like there was one person I used to work with who'd always reference procedures and they would always get them wrong. SOP dash dot whatever. That's the non complaint. So then you pull it up and it's just like electronic signatures. Electronic signatures or something. So I'm definitely not the try to reference, but my point is that it was some section that I didn't even know that there was a section of the CFR that was that.
Right. So there's on the drug development side, you have GLPs, which I believe I'm going to get the number wrong. So it's 56 or 58. Then you have IRBs, which is in there. You have investigator requirements for financial disclosures. And then you also have just the informed consent, the protecting human research subjects. And I believe that's like, it's not in 21. It's in another part of the federal code, but I believe it's 42. But when I took a class as part of my master's work at Northeastern on the pharma development, and they go through all of those various other regulations, GLPs being the big one, but then you have the financial disclosures and IRBs and informed consent. And there's a federal regulation for each one of those.
Okay. And so, you know, what you're saying essentially is that the pre-process on the device side, while there may be some things that are outside of the QSR per se, most of it is in the QSR.
Yeah, the QSR is the full quality system. And it does point to like you mentioned earlier, 803 for medical device reportables, adverse events. Sure. If you're going
I don't think labeling is in 820, is it?
No. So there are labeling controls for manufacturing. But the labeling regulatory requirements, those are in 801, I believe.
Yeah, but you're saying that the QSR model versus the CGMP model inherently focuses on quality system things. So you have maybe one level higher and a bigger scope, whereas the CGMPs are a little bit more tightly focused on manufacturing. It starts with control unit and ends with how do you deal with non-conforming product? I forget the wording that you used.
Yeah.
But okay. And so that's the struggle if you're a drug person being exposed to device maybe the first time. You having gone through a big background in device, what's the struggle on the opposite end? Device person being introduced to the drug side.
Right. So there are if you go into a device facility, for the most part, you'll come across clean rooms. You'll come across some other environmental controls, contamination controls. It's a lot different when you get into a pharma facility. So those controls are heightened, and you get a lot more. You have the different clean room classification, and there's more focus on the contamination control part of it. There's a lot more focus on test method validation in pharmaceutical compared to device. Not a lot of test method validation, at least in my career on the device side. It is done, but a lot of times you're using the industry accepted ASTM standards, where on the pharma side, even if you're using a USP, you still have to do that method validation, show that it works on your equipment in your lab with your people, right? So, and then within the pharma space, there's a lot, I would say, that for the vice individuals, and this was even for myself, like the stability requirements are much more stringent. So you have a full stability program, and your changes, when you're making changes, the notification requirements for change management on the pharma side is a lot higher and more rigorous. So those would be the biggest things that I would say from my own transition over, where I'd had to do the most learning, because you have to worry about extractable and leachables and a whole lot of other things, where a lot of times if I have a catheter, my packaging is not causing a problem with my catheter. But if I have a pharmaceutical injectable product inside a bag and there's a problem with the ink, well, that can leach into my product, and now I have unknown peaks in my chromatograph, and okay, I have a serious problem now. So
can you walk me through your background, maybe as you went from, because you're like full in pharma now.
Yeah, I was. In my new role at Allotex, I'm going back to device, but I was.
You are.
When I was at Fresenius, full in pharma, yes.
Okay, so now you're a standalone device or combo product?
So it's a combo product. It's tissue device. So it's basically tissue's probably considered a biologic, but it's a tissue implant, and it's covered under 21271. So 21 CFR 1271 GMPs.
Interesting. And so is that a new element for you?
Yeah, just started in May full time. And yeah, I've never worked with a tissue product before, so that's brand new to me. And that was, I wasn't really excited about leaving pharma because I wanted to spend a few more years in pharma, but then this opportunity popped up and it offered not only the tissue product experience, but a pre-market approval as well, so a PMA. So I was like, I can't pass that up. I've got to chase that because I haven't done a PMA before.
That's good. Cool. As far as, you know, your career, you moved around quite a bit. You mentioned that you spent time as an auditor. That was after you had spent time in QA and manufacturing?
Right. So just quick rundown.
Yeah.
I started with co-ops at General Electric, and I did a stint in design, a stint in manufacturing, and then a stint in quality. And then I came out of college and I went to Cardinal Health. And I started in distribution, basically in warehouse. I was in a rotational program, and then I went to manufacturing, and then I went into quality regulatory. And I did a lot of regulatory work at Cardinal before moving back into supplier quality.
Supplier quality?
Yeah.
Regulatory. So, that's a, I haven't heard that jump before.
Yeah. So the role that I did at Cardinal, I worked a lot with suppliers, but I was collecting regulatory information for different types of product development that we were doing.
Sure.
So then when I moved to Covidien, I was doing basically supplier audits all the time. So they had a pretty large backlog of supplier audits, and I was tasked with getting it up to current, making everything current and eliminating the backlog. So I was very lucky at that time that I found basically what I would call a GMP wizard. So I had a mentor who had already worked in pharma for 15 years, had worked in device for 10 years, and he knew both regulations forwards and backwards. And he helped me learn the GMPs. And he gave me some advice like, look, if you really want to become an expert, it's difficult when you're auditing suppliers, because they can hide stuff from you, they can withhold information. But if you become a corporate auditor and you're going around doing corporate audits of quality systems, you're internal, they can't hide things from you. They can try, but they have to give it to you. So I joined the corporate audit group. I went around auditing. At that time, Covidien had 64 different sites that included the Mallinckrodt pharmaceutical sites. So I audited basically every other week for 3 years. I was on the road auditing manufacturing facilities, quality system, and learned a ton at that time. And from there, I moved on to Waters Corporation, where I was tasked with getting their quality system ready for an FDA inspection. And I spent quite a bit of time building that quality team and building that quality system. And then I went to Europe and worked at a wound care company from Sweden called Mölnlycke Healthcare for 2 years, harmonizing their quality system globally. And then I spent 2 years at Fresenius Kabi. And basically, the pandemic had put a lot of stress and strain on the quality system and on the workforce. And I was tasked with coming in and helping relieve that strain and rebuild the quality team.
And you were site head of quality, right?
Yep. Head of quality, 600 person facility. I had 55 people in the QA group.
I remember early on in my career, and I actually had a conversation with somebody about this, and they mentioned that kind of the non-traditional trajectories are a lot more common now than they were 10 or especially 20 years ago. But one of the companies that I worked at before, it was basically a requirement for you to be a VP of operations or a VP of quality. You had to be a manufacturing site lead.
Yeah.
Or head of QA at a manufacturing site. It was a requirement, basically.
It's funny that you say that, because at Covidien, it wasn't a hard requirement, but it was kind of an unspoken requirement that in order to take a corporate role as a director of QA or even a VP of QA, you needed to be a quality manager in a plant. Because if you're going to manage a bunch of plant quality managers, you need to have sat in their chair so that you know what they're dealing with.
Right. And so you've done that effectively, right?
Yeah. I left the Covidien corporate site in Mansfield and moved into a manufacturing facility quality manager role for two years.
But I guess the distinction that I'm making is there's a difference between being a manager in a manufacturing site from my upbringing in med device at that company. It was like you had to have been the head of quality, i.e., you are the person on the line if anything goes.
Absolutely.
And so what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, I was head of quality. I didn't have the title head of quality, but I was leading the quality team at my manufacturing plant in upstate New York. At Waters corporate site, I was head of quality. And then at Fresenius Kabi.
Wasn't new.
Yeah, I had led quality teams in manufacturing plants before, but specifically at Fresenius Kabi, it was a pharma quality team. So I still had someone in quality systems and compliance. I had a regulatory affairs person, stability manager, manufacturing QA, and validation. QA validation was under my group. So it was working with my managers, again, to make sure that they're covering all of their elements. And then, of course, we're problem solvers. So, hey, we have this deviation that's holding up 17 batches. All right, let's get the right people in the room and let's figure out what we're doing to resolve this.
So I wanted to maybe move to talk about some of your, I don't want to call them extracurriculars, but you know, you've been part of AAMI for 8-9 years now as a faculty member. You know, you have your booming kind of YouTube channel, right? And I love seeing the consistency. I think you're at something like 150 videos in that ballpark, 125 to 150. Well,
yeah, 125 is probably closer, but yeah.
Yeah. Can you maybe talk about those? I mean, talk about AAMI first, because I think that it's interesting. You've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah. So in 2013, I was working for my boss at that time. He was fantastic, and he was supporting me doing master's work. And at the same time, this AAMI thing came up, and there was a call put out from AAMI saying, hey, we're looking for people to apply to become a faculty member. I was like, you know, I like to teach. I know the regulations. I can do this. AAMI courses are fantastic. They're some of the best you can go to. So I asked my boss, he was like, absolutely. If they accept you, I will support it. You can do four of them a year. So 4 a year. And I was like, all right. So I applied. It was a pretty rigorous process. I was phone screened by multiple faculty members. They brought 40 people down to Virginia, and we went through a train-to-trainer, a two-day train-to-trainer, and we were being graded the entire time. And then after it was done, they selected basically, I believe, five or six out of the 40 to become faculty. And I was luckily part of that group. And at that point, I started to do AAMI courses. And my first one was in Virginia, the quality system course with John Malloy. And he was the lead faculty. And it was fantastic. And I kind of never looked back from then. Before the pandemic, I only did three or four courses a year because you had to travel. And when you have to travel, you're not in the office. So it was tough to be out of the office more than that during a year. But when the pandemic hit and everything went remote, and being in Europe, 6-hour time difference, I was able to do a lot more AMI courses because I could do my day job in the morning and then in the afternoon do the AMI course until midnight. It was just a really long day. So currently I teach 6 AMI courses. I teach the quality system course. I teach design controls, purchasing controls, CAPA, 510K and de novo, and I teach the lead auditor course. So, and it's been fantastic. I learn during every course too. So not only do I get to share what I know, but I learn from the class and the other faculties.
Have the classes that you focused on teaching changed over time?
So they have evolved. So in 2017, 2018, we did a full update of all the courses. And right now, AMI is working on another full update of the courses, a refresh. Because, I mean, in the 2017, 2018, the refresh was to integrate 1345 in. And then now the refresh is going to have to be done for the new QMSR. So FDA is going to adopt the new 820. They will adopt 1345, and that content will have to update the training material to match how they approach that.
And FDA is part of AMI, right?
FDA has, so there is an agreement between AMI and FDA. And in that agreement, FDA supports AMI courses. So if it's a public course, there will be an FDA faculty that participates. And then AMI also does training and other types of work for the FDA. So yeah, there's a partnership there. I'm not sure of all the specifics, but yes, there's a partnership.
Now, the last thing I want to talk about is your executive series with Quality Systems Explained. So
yep.
Why focus on Quality Systems?
Yeah, so Quality Systems is where my expertise is, and it's something that I like to teach. So in my stint at Waters, wind back to even at Covidien, when I was auditing, I looked at auditing as kind of, it was a two-way street from the standpoint of, I'm here to understand the health of your quality system, but I'm also here to explain the regulatory requirements to you. So it should be educational for you as the auditee, and I should be learning about your quality system. So it's both ways. And if I read your document and I think it's overly complex, I'll let you know. Now, if you don't understand why the document is written that way, I can explain what the regulatory requirements are and give you kind of some ideas on how you may be able to strengthen it, what I've seen other people do. So I've always approached it as a learning opportunity, both for me and the auditee. And then when I got to Waters, I found that I was training a lot of people on quality systems, like people in the industry for 15, 20, 30 years, they didn't know quality systems. And I was also hiring a lot of fresh college grads who didn't know quality systems. So I'm teaching this stuff a lot. And I was like, you know what? I've got a lot of this information. I've got a lot of stories. I'm able to take something complex. And what I like to do is take it complex, break it down and make it simple, simple story. And from that standpoint, I was like, well, how can I help more people? How can I get a broader reach? How can I establish my credentials as a subject matter expert? And the YouTube channel was something that came across my plate as an idea of something I could do. I had never edited a video in my life. I had never recorded anything other than my kids' softball games and maybe a mountain that I hiked up doing it. So I found another YouTube channel that talked about making videos and editing and building a YouTube following.
Which one was that?
Primal Video. It's two guys out of Australia. They're fantastic. I watched all their videos on editing software, end cards, intros, writing scripts, what mics to buy, how to do lighting. They're fantastic. So I watched all of their stuff, and then I downloaded some free editing software, recorded a video, edited it, sent it to my buddies, and they're like, your lighting is bad, your mic sounds terrible. So went through a couple iterations of that. And then I was just like, you know what? It's still, my lighting is still not the best. My mic isn't awesome, but let's put it up. Yep. Let's go. Right. And you can probably see some of my earlier videos, where I was recording in my apartment in Sweden. It wasn't the best. Lighting was really challenging and sound was tough, but I've evolved from there. And now that I'm back in the States, I don't have a great recording place yet, but I'm working on one and I'll start recording there. So it's gotten better and better.
Yeah. I was talking to someone about a podcast recording that's upcoming. And the person was like, hey, before we start, it was like an intro call because they hadn't really done many podcasts before.
Yeah.
And they were like, hey, I listened to episode like 35 and episode like 80. And you sound like two different interviewers. And kind of to your point, just the improvement that you see, and it happens kind of quickly, especially in the beginning. Yeah. I mean, a couple of years is not a long time.
Yep. Yeah. My goal was to do one video a week. Now, in this summer period, I haven't met that. So I'll probably get back on the one video a week in September, October. But I'll try to get one out every couple of weeks or one out a month. But I mean, with the 3-minute videos, if I get my scripts down well, it takes me 10 or 12 minutes to do the recording. And then I edit it down to 3 minutes and then do the other production work. So yeah, it's work. But at the end of the day, get that information out there. I've got a lot of questions from people sent in from around the world, which has been great. I try to answer those. Sometimes takes me a little bit longer than I want, but I answer the questions. I answer the questions on the videos and just try to help people learn this stuff.
As we move to close, I think your kind of approach to the videos where you're just marinating every section by section, you know, you did all of the QSRs.
Yep.
I think you did 13485 as well, and now you're in the CGMPs on the drug side, right?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah, I think just, I don't know anybody that's done that level of deep dive where, because it's like Feynman technique, right? Read it, teach it, repeat it, you know, just that's so cool. What's a book that changed your life?
Okay. Yeah, there's a book that I read a while ago. So there's kind of two, but I'll lead with the one that I like the most. So there's a book called The War of Art.
I love that book, Stephen Pressfield.
Yes, fantastic.
Amazing. So
it's a simple read. It's about 2 hours. And the whole point of the book is about overcoming resistance, right? So there are all these things that we say to ourselves about, okay, I want to do this, but then you don't do it. Or I want to get in shape and you don't do it. Or I'd like to lose weight and you don't do it. And that book kind of really boils it down to do it. Just do it. Just start.
You know what? My favorite thing about the book is the distinguishing between the amateur and the professional, right? The professional approaches their work a certain way. The amateur, the difference, you know, I love that. And obviously whenever you're doing anything creative, it could be as simple as writing a document or editing a podcast or taking out the trash. Yep. Right. Like there have been so many times where it's just like, just move the rock, move it just a quarter inch.
Right.
It'll start rolling. And I actually, you know, because I ride a bike, right. I think about the resistance concept a lot because you know, getting faster is not about pedaling harder. Most of the time it's about getting less drag.
Yeah. And you've got to learn that. Someone's got to tell you that.
Yeah. So I know that book. I've recommended that book to a lot of people. It's one of the ones that it's kind of like a daily read too, because you can read like the chapters are short. And it's so short. Love that book. What's the other one?
Yeah. So when you specifically said change your life, there's another one that really did that, but it's not business related. It's more personal related. And I mean, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And, yeah. So just the whole concept of buying assets and just the whole concept of assets and liabilities. Liabilities take money out of your pocket. Assets put money in your pocket. I read that right after I graduated from high school, or not high school, right after I graduated from college. And it basically changed my buying habits, like completely. Before that, I was buying a lot of liabilities and I stopped doing that. So yeah, that would be the other one. But it's more of like some people love Robert Kiyosaki and some people do not. So it can be a bit polarizing. So
yeah, I mean, there are more attitudes towards money than there are towards quality, right? So that's where can people find you, Aaron?
Yeah, so look me up on LinkedIn, Aaron Snyder. Send me a request. I'll accept it and I'll shoot you back a note. If you have any questions on quality systems, I'm happy to help with those. I might not reply right away. I might be traveling or be busy with work, but I'll get back to you within a week or so. And then you got my YouTube channel, Quality Systems Explained. I break down all those quality system elements. So that's the best ways to reach out to me.
Well, thank you for coming on to the show, Aaron. It's been awesome talking to you. I'm sure this will be the first of many.
Yeah, I hope to come back and do it again, but that'd be great.